Blog Talk Radio.
This week on Backroom Politics, chaos continues on the Gaza Strip as the rocket fire exchange continues to occur, while here in the United States, the border crisis in the southern section of our country continues to loom with the ever-growing population of unaccompanied minors. The Kremlin, the CIA, and the battle over a forbidden book. Special guest, Washington Post Peter Finn will join us talking about his book, The Zhivago Affair. And redistricting in Texas, possibly Florida. Is this enough to get redistricting out of the hands of the legislature and into the hands of people who know what they're doing? Listen, tell me a story today on Back.
Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., this is Backroom Politics. To join the discussion, you can call toll-free 1-877-662-3713. And now, the moderator of Backroom Politics, Justin Russell.
Good afternoon out there in Radio Land. It's Tuesday. We're back live here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. It is the best political talk show you've never heard of. It's Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. Joining me to my left, as he usually does, he is the former eight-term member of Congress representing the 2nd Congressional District of Washington. He's the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Hello, Congressman.
Hello, and I hope everybody's doing well in this weather.
I hope so, too. And to my 11 o'clock, he is the former floor chief for then-Congressman Gerald R. Ford, former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is 30 Rock's own, Bob Hines. Hello, Bob.
Hello, Justin. Glad to be back alive.
It is good to be back live. And to my 11:30, he is the former lobbyist for 20th Century Fox, longtime Washington insider and former executive director of the Democratic Party of the great state of Maryland. He's Carl Tuvin. Hi, Carl.
Hello, Justin, and we're all waiting for the vortex to come and cool us off.
I hope so. God, I hate this weather.
Except for Capitol Hill.
Oh, God, true. And to my 1 o'clock, he is across the table. He is the former Undersecretary of Commerce for International Affairs. He is longtime Senate insider and longtime Senate staffer and a very distinguished and happy fellow from the Stimson Center. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Justin, gentlemen.
And to my right, he is longtime political operative and attorney here in Washington, D.C., a very left-wing kind of Democratic kind of guy. He is Dan Lipner. Hello, Dan.
Hey, Justin. Glad to be here.
Thanks for having us. Lots of stuff we're going to have going on at the 5 o'clock hour. We're going to have Peter Finn from the Washington Post in to talk about his book, The Zhivago Affair. Great story if you haven't read up on it. He's going to tell us all about the book. But we've got a big show to talk about. First up is the continuing crisis inside Gaza. Since we have not been on the air in 2 weeks, we'll give you a little bit of quick background. Situation between the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli government got heated up after 3 Israeli teenagers were, for all intents and purposes, murdered in Gaza. It created a whole new security force, and then Israeli vigilantes went out and they attacked Palestinian youth, and they were killed, and that has created now a what has now become a conflict. Some are calling it now even a new six-day war, but for what is going on, it has escalated over the past 7 days. We now know, as of this morning, that the Egyptian government has proposed a ceasefire, which this morning the Israeli cabinet accepted the terms of that ceasefire. However, the Palestinians had some pushback on that. It is a proposed ceasefire. It would allow the Egyptians to call for a de-escalation of fighting starting at 9 a.m. local time in Gaza, with the total calm of 12 hours later. Within 48 hours of the ceasefire, Egypt would, quote, high-level delegations from both Israeli and Palestinian factions would join at the table to talk in indirect talks in terms of implementing a final truce. As of this afternoon, rocket fire has continued. This is a really destabilizing question, situation, and just a really big powder keg in an area of the country, or the area of the world, that is just such an already unstable at best. Alan Moore, let me start with you. This escalated very quickly. Some have compared it to a similar interaction, a similar violence that happened back in 2009, but those who are in Israel and in Palestine and a lot of observers globally are saying this is nothing like 2009. This thing's really got some instability and could escalate even further than it already has. What do you think?
Well, I'm the wrong one to ask about a comparison to 2009 because I don't recall enough about what happened in 2009. What I can say is this. It happened very quickly because the region is always a powder keg, and over a period of years of relative quiet and then failed talks, most recently with the high-profile efforts of U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, which in effect came to naught, the acquisition by Hamas of still more missiles that have still longer range under presumably the control of more than one entity embedded in civilian neighborhoods, looking, I would sense, for a provocation, found one, and started lobbing hundreds. They're now up to nearly 1,000 missiles. The Israelis have not been standing aside doing nothing for the last few years. They strengthened the so-called Iron Dome anti-missile system, and they have continued to expand and improve access to underground shelters. They've got air raid sirens that see incoming and alert people. So what you've got is 1,000 missiles over the last couple of weeks coming in from Gaza, and then today someone died for the first time on the Israeli side from one of these missiles. But by and large, it's disruptive, it's terrorism. The death toll has been low. The building damage has been higher, but then they've responded to the areas from which these things came and other targets where they have identified leaders of Hamas. So you've got a couple of hundred deaths and hundreds more injuries on the Gaza side. It is a god-awful mess. Both sides have it in their interest at times to escalate, and then both sides have it in their interest. But those interests don't always line up neatly and evenly. Each time this happens, and it's happened a couple of times in the last 8 years, everything seems to escalate. And we can only hope that reason will prevail, and that if Hamas says we will agree to a ceasefire, that they have the ability to do that. And that's a huge question, whether they really can control all of these independent
people. Carl Tooven, you know, when we look at the Israeli response, it seems that the normally hawkish Benjamin Netanyahu took a somewhat softer stance this morning when he proposed the Egyptian proposal and the cabinet adopted that proposal before the deadline. It seems that Tel Aviv has engaged in, look, let's de-escalate this at some point. That's a very drastic change from the Benjamin Netanyahu that we know. What would compel him, in your opinion, to do this?
Well, first of all, you got to look at the history. In 2010, we went into Gaza. In 2012, we had the dome. which protected Israel. We have the dome today.
The Iron Dome.
We have the dome today. The Iron Dome today, which protects Israel, except for this one child who was killed sometime in the last 24 hours. I think he does not want to attack Gaza. But if they persist, I think he would have to say, okay, we're going to go in, we're going to occupy, we're going to clean out these spots as best we can, and then we will resist. But I really don't think he and the Knesset wants to do that. They would like to have somebody come in and moderate it.
Dan Lipner.
It's a tough situation, but it's worth noting that there's a separation between what's going on in Gaza and what's going on in the West Bank. That Gaza has been the headache. The West Bank has been relatively stable. Not to say that they're the best of friends with Israel, but the Palestinian Authority has actually been doing all right. It's Hamas and the extremist veto that they've been exercising repeatedly that make the whole situation difficult. But it's also worth noting, we did mention the murder of the three Israeli youths, one of which was actually had dual citizenship as American. But there's also a Palestinian youth that was also abducted and murdered by Israeli radicals as well. So there's a lot at play here. And if you don't have what the Israelis have been looking for its entire existence, is a partner in peace. And if you don't have a credible partner, what do you do? And that's been a reoccurring theme throughout all the conflicts since Israel's creation.
But Bob Hines, when we look at the U.S. response, the U.S. response, according to large groups that I've talked to of international observers, has been lackluster at best. There hasn't been a really defined message coming out of Washington. Secretary Kerry has not really upped the game to get this de-escalated. It seems to me that this is just another stick in the Obama foreign policy that they just can't get around. This is now a national security issue with our alliance with Israel. Can they fix it?
No, I don't think the United States can fix it. I mean, literally, if Hamas keeps wanting to throw missiles at the Israelis are going to respond. And they seem to be willing to do it. But and there's nothing that we can do to really encourage anybody else. I mean, obviously, if you're having missiles thrown at you, you're going to do something to stop them if you can. And I don't blame the Israelis for it. I think they should. That's normal. And I don't think there's any way that we would have any influence at all on those crazy people in Gaza.
Does Congressman Al, did Obama's original take on Israel, because a lot of Israeli supporters here in America, they felt that he had given a lukewarm reception when he first became president in his first term, was more sympathetic to the Palestinian plight versus the Israeli plight. Has that taken away some of our substance and the ability to try and broker a deal in this current conflict?
That takes a little bit of thought. That isn't where I thought you were going. It seems to me that the answer is probably yes, but not to a huge degree. The thing that I thought about the policy that the president had originally was that we had been kind of seen as the loyal ally, the big brother, the handholder of Israel, and I thought, for years, we've kind of overplayed that. Not that we weren't necessary to be involved, but that we were kind of overplaying it. So I welcomed what the president did at that time. Since then, I'm not so sure.
But, Carl Tuven.
There's one problem with the Egyptians being the people that brings us together, because Egypt closed the tunnels and cut off money from Hamas a couple of years ago. And a lot of people are saying that, you know, Hamas, you know, might not want to sit down with the Egyptians and the Israelis to bargain this out.
Well, it's worth noting, 1,000 missiles were smuggled in. So I'm going to guess those tunnels may have reopened along the way. This is not exactly a...
Right.
That's true, and that's why we're trying to hit those tunnels today.
But, you know, but it seems every time that when we get into a conflict, especially now with the Iron Dome system over Israel, that the numbers are just unusually large of casualties, and the Palestinian Authority is now reporting 80% civilian casualty rates as a result of the recent escalation of violence. Israel has lost a total of 4 individuals as a result of the Palestinian aggression. It seems to me that the Palestinian Authority should realize anytime they want to escalate this, this is going to be a large-scale hit on their civilian population. Why does that elude them? Go to Alan Moore and then Carl Tubin.
First, remember, this is not the Palestinian Authority. This is Hamas. And I wanted to, first of all, mention, building on Dan's comment, that when the Palestinian Authority and Hamas announced 2 months ago that they were going to join forces, that scared the hell out of Israel and the rest of the world. Because before, there was some hope that you could keep these two sides who are in conflict with each other separate. And as Dan said, in the West Bank, things have been relatively stable. And the problem is coming from the Hamas-controlled area in Gaza. And it's hard to know whether there's any buyers.
But let me jump in. Hold on. Let me just jump in here real quick, though. I want to ask you this question. When you talk about separating the Palestinian Authority from Hamas, it seems to me, at least my personal view, that you can't separate them, that they have literally become such a powerful force in the governance of Palestine that one equates to the other. Why is that an unfair assumption? Why is it unfair, Carl Tubin?
Because Hamas is acting on its own. They are trying to show that they have control of Gaza. They're trying to throw a wrench and say, look what we've done to Israel. The problem is with the death toll is that Hamas puts these missile sites and their ammunition sites
in civilian targets,
under mosques, in schools, next to schools, everywhere, and Israel has been dropping leaflets and saying to people, get out of your homes, get out of the area, etc. And Hamas is saying, don't leave your homes, you stay there.
Dan Lipner.
Well, the problem is bigger than that, because Gaza is not a sustainable entity. There's its size smaller than D.C. with a population 2.5 times the size, with no commerce or ability to trade with anyone. So the question is, how do you stop breeding extremists when you have a population that has pretty much no other choice than to try and fight for sustaining their own lives? And it does. Now, the Israeli pushback in response to the attacks is also not unfounded, but unless the international community says, let's make Gaza into something that can sustain itself in some reasonable way, of course there's going to be continued escalations because people want to survive.
Bob Hines.
I think one of the things we should be happy about is that the Palestinian Authority, which has, you know, in effect joined themselves in with Hamas and the Gaza group, they have stayed out of this completely. They have not made any violent statements about what a terrible thing the Israelis are doing. They have kept quiet. I think it's a very wise decision on their part, and I think that at some point, and I don't know, you know, it's hard to tell because the folks who are running Gaza are such a bunch of rather dangerous people, and are more interested in killing people than they are anything else. The only thing they're doing is killing their own people.
Well, I mean, that's obvious just from the casualty numbers coming out of the region. But, Alan Moore, this morning, in the announcement of the acceptance of the Egyptian proposal for ceasefire, Benjamin Netanyahu said, and I quote, "We have accepted the Egyptian proposal in order to provide the opportunity for demilitarizing the Gaza Strip of rockets and tunnels by diplomatic ways." He further goes on, quote, "But if Hamas does not accept the ceasefire proposal, and right now it looks that way, Israel will have every international legitimacy to expand its military operation to restore the necessary calm." That sounds like ground invasion into Gaza to me. Is this a possibility, and does that put Israel into a really difficult situation?
Well, they're in a difficult situation. Yes, if there's a realistic possibility that they might do a ground invasion, but whatever they do, there's going to be enormous amount of anger in some parts of the world and support in others. I think that Netanyahu's statement is very interesting, though, where he says, "We accept the Egyptian proposal," which, as I understand it, was just, "Let's have a ceasefire and then
we'll talk
from there." But he overcharacterizes, it seems, by saying, "I accept their proposal to get the, to close the tunnels and
get rid of the missiles
and get the missiles out," which I don't think was
the, part of the Egyptian proposal.
Now, I don't have a big quarrel with a politician taking a grain of something and letting it grow. Shocking, politicians do that all the time. But I don't sense that there's a huge stomach throughout Israel to have a major land invasion of thousands and thousands of troops with lots of casualties on both sides, clearly more on the Gaza side, and clearly lots of civilians.
Carl Tuvin, though, there is a peace section of the general population inside Israel. There's a large sector of the population, particularly in Tel Aviv, that are pushing for a more peaceful approach to Palestine in dealing with not only the Palestinian authorities, but obviously with Hamas. Does ground invasion put his government, him being Benjamin Netanyahu, in a difficult situation? Can his government survive a full-scale invasion?
It's a possibility. The only time he's going to do a full-scale invasion is if Hamas keeps throwing rockets at Israel and if they won't stop. Then he'll do it. And as far as the rest of the world is concerned, Israel has gotten support from people that they hadn't had support before. Also, it's even been noted that on some of the TV stations, CNN, I think Jake Tapper has come out very strongly for Israel, and other networks have come out very strongly for Israel. So, you know, that has to be into it. You're right, there is a peace group that would want peace at any cost at the last round of talks, and it just didn't happen.
Bob Hines.
I doubt that Israel will want to send troops in. They would increase the number of Israelis killed very, very much, just because they'd be on the ground and fighting. It seems to me that all they have to do at this time right now is every time anybody throws a missile at them, they throw a whole bunch back, and they aim them at where their missiles are coming from, and they do what they can to stop the system. Eventually, I think that the pressure is going to be so great from whatever friends Hamas has anyplace else, they're just killing their own people. They're going to be stopped by outside friends saying you're just killing yourself.
Dan Lipner,
what evidence of this, of the 60 some odd years that this has been going on, that's been the case? I mean, the great line that the Palestinians never miss an opportunity is this continuing theme.
Yeah, but they have stopped at times, and I think they'll stop again.
They've stopped from brute force, not from negotiation.
Oh, no, I think they'll stop shooting rockets over at Israel eventually.
Once they stop having rockets when they stop shooting rockets.
Right. Yeah. Congressman Al.
I really tend to agree with Dan. I read a book recently about great feuds.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought one that was probably going to be a funny one was the Hatfields and the McCoys. They had all these serious historical, and they have. Well, it turns out that was not silly and fun. It was a very serious thing. And how it finally ended was that grandpa and son and grandchildren, each generation moved a little bit farther away from being interested in this until finally grandpa was so old he was off selling peanuts somewhere, and the younger Hatfields and McCoys weren't interested in it any longer. That is not going to happen in the Mideast because countries aren't like individuals. The generational changes don't happen that way. Nobody is going to lose interest in the Mideast, and I think it's going to be around for a long time.
Dan Lipner, when we look at the U.S. traditionally having the ability to convey a message of restraint to the leadership in Tel Aviv, particularly with Benjamin Netanyahu and previous administrations, we're not there in this current administration. That relationship has been strained. Does the administration possibly regret the fact that they may have taken a proactive approach to the Palestinian question versus the 100% backing of Israel that we've had in the past?
I would push back on that. I would actually say that the Obama administration has followed the Bush administration's lead on this and gone hands off. With the only added caveat of Netanyahu being in office, who has been called out as being a challenging leader, not just with us, but with other world leaders on the stage, that there hasn't been much. I would say that the Obama administration's absolute silence on the issues of the abduction of both the Israeli youth and the Palestinian youth does give a silence to the moral authority that this is something that is not done on either side. That opportunity to speak up and that moral authority was something that is lost, and that is inexcusable.
Carl Toobin, last comment.
John Kerry has been in this thing up to his eyeballs. And I think he has tried to bring these two groups together, and it just didn't happen. And John Kerry is still involved in this. He was going to, if they had accepted both sides had accepted the Egyptian plan, he was going to be in Cairo to try to help move this thing along.
Yeah, but
so the president might not be personally involved. But Kerry has, I think, been there and tried to be very helpful to both sides.
But Alan Moore, real quickly, the last 2 minutes we've got in the segment, when we look at John Kerry's comments, his comment today was, I cannot condemn strongly enough the actions of Hamas in so brazenly firing rockets in the face of a goodwill effort to offer a ceasefire. The Palestinians come back and say, we were not part of this announcement. We were not part of this agreement. And Hamas and the Palestinian Authority are saying, look, we didn't have a dog in this fight when you guys came up with this. We're not agreeing to this. It just seems that we're continuing to miss the ball on having our finger on what the current situation is in these international efforts.
You know, in this particular case, as has been said, we've got about 70 years almost now of history, and we don't control this. We can operate around the edges, around the fringe, but when things bubble up and they burst, to some extent, we have to wait it out. We have to wait till they run out of missiles. We have to wait until international sentiment at some point turns in a particular way. We have to wait until a Hamas missile lands on a hospital and kills a couple hundred people. So there are things that the U.S. can't do. I certainly don't disagree with Dan that we've probably missed a few opportunities to take a, a higher moral authority, that I don't think that would have affected the outcome, but it would have been a reminder that there are things that the U.S. feels strongly enough about that it's not afraid to speak out. We've gotten very tentative all around the world. But in this particular case, it's not there yet. Hopefully it will be soon.
Congressman, now 30 seconds.
But the idea that there is a solution that can be brought about if we do the right thing, and if we do this, that, and the other, and it doesn't work, we have failed, is total nonsense. We are not going to solve this thing.
Good
Our
point.
Job is to keep a lid on it as much as we can, to manage it as much as
keep
we can.
Keep it contained.
Keep it contained, and 70 years from now, we will probably be dealing with the same thing.
Well, we're going to obviously be keeping an eye on this. Well, we're going to be keeping an eye on it. This is probably going to be a topic next week as well, so keep tuned in. When we come back, we're going to talk about the ever-escalating crisis here in America on the southern border. The unaccompanied minor situation continues to escalate and continues to baffle the federal government. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. You know, for those who listen to Backroom Politics and know about Shelley's Backroom, they think of it as some sort of cigar bar where politicians go to smoke their cigars and drink their martinis. Actually, what you don't know about Shelley's Backroom, Shelley's Backroom has one of the greatest menus in the city. I kid you not. You've got the campfire wings, famous campfire wings. 1 pound of roasted, not fried, seasoned marinated jumbo chicken rings served with their own special honey mustard sauce. Folks, if you like chicken wings, you've never had the campfire wings. Best wings in the city, bar none, I guarantee. If you don't like it, Al, you can call us up and tell us that you don't like it. You have daily specials. Come down on a day when they have the Justin Chicken Sandwich, the sandwich named after me, breaded chicken breast, provolone cheese, thick-cut bacon on a Kaiser roll served with a honey mustard sauce. Folks, it doesn't get more artery-clogging than that, but it is worth it. Come down to Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., the premier sponsor of Backroom Politics. Live at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. Changing gears, getting more domestic. We've got a situation that continues to escalate over the past month down on the southern border. The unaccompanied minor situation is becoming a humanitarian crisis. The latest coming out of the southern border, according to a Washington Post ABC poll, finds that the public is unhappy with the administration's handling it. 58% disapprove and are unhappy with the way that the administration has handled the unaccompanied minor program. As such, we continue to see a huge influx of minors making a very dangerous trip out of some very dangerous areas. Since we last broadcast, the Obama administration requests a $3.7 billion budget supplement for dealing with this unaccompanied minor situation. There have been calls for the use of National Guard. There have been calls for all kinds of things. But the bottom line here is it is quickly escalating out of control. Congressman Al, you had a thought on this.
I wanted to ask a question about the poll. So many people are opposed to the administration program. Do they even know what the administration program is? Does the administration know?
The problem is the administration.
That's never a requirement for polling questions. You don't have to know what they're talking about. But actually, it's are you in a way that's okay. It's do you like what they're doing? Answer no.
Yeah, and the reality is
that because they want more support for the children coming in, or they want less support, more resistance to the children coming in. It's a very important.
I do,
Alan Moore.
Yeah, I think the answer on that one is they want more resistance to the children coming in. There's a sense that we have lost control of our own border, and as we all recall, in most of the discussion about immigration reform, it's secure the border first, and then we can find a way to keep the 11 million people who were here prior to 2007 legal, and then. If those individuals go through a screening process and can prove some things, they can get on a very long path for citizenship.
But here's my problem. But here's my problem with this, though. But here's my problem with this is, first of all, the concept that even going back to the Bush administration of operational control of the border is a myth. We are never going to quote unquote have operational control of the border. We don't have a system to do it unless you build a 100-foot wall across Canada and across the Mexican border and put Coast Guard vessels at every major port of entry coming into the country.
And out,
and there are people that want that.
Foot ladders.
Yes, that too. But go ahead, Alan Moore.
Yeah, I mean, the definition of what border security is, you know, is something people argue about. And typically they say, not that this is easy to measure, you have to keep out 90% of the people who would otherwise come. Well, we don't know what that number means, but we have spent billions of dollars on fences. We have spent billions of dollars on high-tech surveillance equipment.
But SBINet was a disaster.
Border control people. I'm just saying I don't think one can say it's a meaningless concept. I think one can agree that there are many difficult challenges. But what we've got on the southern border is sort of a perfect storm of there being some obvious holes, if you will, where coyotes can bring guys across. We've got a flood of people from three countries who've crossed the country of Mexico for some complicated reasons, some of which have to do with mistakes that this administration has made,
right,
and some of which have to do with U.S. law passed in good faith in 2008, which when added, which said, we'll turn you away if you're from Mexico or Canada, if we stop you at the border, but if you're from another country, we think you might be a sexual trafficking victim. We're going to screen you. That piece added to the president's...
The contiguous part of this,
decision to not send home minors who were here since before 2007...
Dan Lipner.
...sent a signal to the people of Central America, come on down, you can get in, and you will be able to stay.
I can't wait to hear Dan Lipner. This is going to be awesome. Dan.
Okay, a couple of different items. One, this has absolutely nothing to do with border security. Literally zero. These kids aren't jumping fences. They're not smuggling through a hole. They're turning themselves in. There's a reason wait a minute.
They're turning them on the U.S. side.
They're still turning themselves in. This is not a border control issue.
These are people fleeing.
These are kids fleeing.
These kids are coming in boxcars. They're coming in boxcars. The train of death. ABC had a great report about the train of death. These kids are literally riding on the roofs of boxcars through three countries in some instances, and they're getting in on these trains. Granted, they're turning themselves in. The fact that they're even getting in is a border control situation.
I'm astonished at the enormous children here. Anger that is going on here.
Let's point out that we're talking about kids.
Exactly.
And the extent of the ugliness that is out there, fighting against these children that are fleeing poverty and actual physical danger in their home country.
Let me finish my point.
And the one thing I will agree on absolutely, and this was the absolute failure and a reoccurring failure of this administration, is the communications point, the ability to talk to the American public and explain what is going on with this situation.
Goes further than that. Let me tell you why. Number one, first of all, I want to say this publicly. There are calls by members of my party to just send them home, just routinely send them home. The problem I have with that is that you have a situation where these kids are going back to, let's use El Salvador, one of the most ruthless street gangs in the Northern Hemisphere is a group called MS-13. These people make the Italian mafia look like priests. They are vicious. They are ugly. They are violent. And they have no care for humanity outside of their group. They send these kids back into El Salvador. They're going to turn into gangbangers. So why not try? And there are programs in this country that would allow them to get, for example, the high school equivalency program out of Department of Education for migrant children. They have housing. They have access to schooling. They can become the productive members of the society without becoming gangbangers. That's number one. Number two, I will say this. The fact is that the Obama administration screwed up the communication. Here's how. When the Obama administration reinstituted the DACA, the Deferred Action for Children, that program, when they reannounced it, every coyote south of the border started going to everybody in Central America saying, hey, guess what? Your kid shows feet dry in the U.S., he gets to stay. He's going to give me $3,000. So they're putting him into harm's way, and the Obama administration did not see this coming, botched it, and now has created its own problem. They should have seen this years ago.
Where do these kids go instead? Let's look at it from a different perspective. Where do these kids go instead?
Got to say one thing.
Go ahead, Carl Tooman.
I disagree with Justin on a lot of things, but this is one thing. You said everything that I was going to say. These kids, to send them back would be a real shunda, a real problem for those kids. And half of them wouldn't survive. And I feel they're here. We should do what Justin said, the programs that can be used, and they can become productive citizens of this country.
I actually agree with you, but there's still the larger problem that there is politics at play, and the politics at play, and this is the glaring silence from the administration where there is clear moral authority to talk about this country being the city on the hill, to be that light for the tired, the poor, the huddled masses yearning to breathe free. There's been nothing, literally silence. On that point, where else is the public supposed to look if the president is silent?
Alan Moore.
Well, the problem for the president is that this is not an example of America being the shining light on the hill. And these people, kids, fleeing from a country that's 1,000 miles away, this is a concerted, planned effort by by their extended family, some of whom are up in America, because somebody's got to come up with the $3,000 to $5,000 to $7,000. Let me tell you how it works with refugees when people really are fleeing. And I know something about the subject. I've been on a member of the board of directors of the International Rescue Committee for more than 30 years. I've visited refugee camps all over the world. I know a little about this. Refugees flee conflict or political persecution, and they get out of harm's way. Sometimes they do it inside their own country. This is what you see in Syria. Those are called internally displaced people. Sometimes they cross a border. Then they become refugees. Where do they go when they cross the border? To a point of safety. They don't travel another 1,000 miles. They just want safety.
I would argue.
Well, fine. You can argue all you want. But let me finish my thought. I'm explaining how it works, at the UN, how it works in U.S. law, how it works in the laws of most countries around the globe. They set up in a camp-type situation, or they disappear into a large city, like in Nairobi, and wait and hope to get a chance to go to a third country. They do not travel 1,000 miles and show up and say, we are fleeing this violence. If we have refugee camps along the southern border of Mexico with these countries, then the U.S. is going to be all over helping set up safe, clean places for true refugees to stay. This is not that. This is this grew out of this miscommunication as much as anything, and we've got 50,000 in 1 month, and they're still flowing in, and nobody on the whole southern border and much of the rest of the country says, oh yeah, we'll take a few hundred, we'll take a few thousand. And senior Hillary Clinton said, we're going to have to send most of them back. This is a fact.
Here's where I disagree with you, using your own term of refugee.
Okay.
Here's where they're refugees. When they leave their country, let's use El Salvador, okay, which is under a grip of criminal enterprise unlike we've seen in Central America in decades. You go and you say, all right, we're going to go to Mexico. That should be the next safe haven, according to what you're saying. That should be the case. Except the problem is that MS-13 and the associated gangs, the associated gang entities in Mexico, including the drug cartels, including the street gangs of Mexico City, and the rural gangs, are all interconnected. That is not a safe haven. So the next logical point is, if I've got to be safe, I'm going to have to make that trek to get to safe haven. That's the southern border. I would say definitively that these kids are, in fact, refugees or should at least be screened for some sort of asylum.
You cannot have it both ways.
Why?
You can't say, on the one hand, the refugees, on the other hand, the administration helped create this problem with poor communication, making it appear as though if you can get here, you're safe. It just doesn't work that way. I'm not saying it's safe anywhere, but what you do with this is true on the borders of Syria. This is true on the borders of any place where there's conflict that we can ever think about, where you set up safe places in countries. You have international monitors, you have the United Nations involved.
Agreed.
Who is setting up one of these safe places, not here?
We're not going to take the millions of people in the world.
I'm not talking about millions of places
here.
In the world. I'm talking about these kids that are escaping. I'm willing to concede your point, Alan. The question is, if not here, then where? And there has been no voice saying, let's set up a safe haven someplace else. These kids are escaping for a reason.
They're escaping because they've got family members who are providing the money to get the thousands of dollars to get them up here because they think they might be able to stay. That's the reason.
So you're saying they're not danger in their home country?
These are 14-year-olds who are making independent decisions. These are 14-year-olds who are following the instructions of families, some of whom are desperate. But
shocking that families would want to go where their extended family might be, as opposed to
showing up in
Mexico City.
Where there's a land of opportunity. It's not Mexico City. I mean, what historically happens with refugees, if they really are under immediate threat, they want to get to a safe place.
Again, I come back to where is that safe place? Pick a spot on the map.
I just described one, the southern border of Mexico.
And I think
there would be a lot of international willingness and support to set up places there. That's not what they want.
But what I'm saying to you is that the southern border of Mexico is not that safe place.
The southern border of Mexico is a huge, massive expanse. There, it would not be that difficult to carve out places. It would not be appealing like America is. Typically, in the cases of refugees, people don't leave and then get to never go back.
But
they want to leave till things stabilize in their country, and then they can return home. If we're saying that any place that we think is going to be in turmoil or violence for the next 20 years, come on down, come on, America, we'll take you all in. That's not what we're going to do. The whole idea of immigration reform is to gain some control, create some rules so that people who observe the rules and wait in line can have a chance, and not just let the people who cut in line for whatever reason jump ahead.
Carl Toobin.
Well, that goes back to a point which has been raised almost every day since this has begun, and that is if the House had moved a bill for immigration reform, some of this possibly wouldn't have happened.
None of this would have been affected by that.
None of it. That I agree with Alan on. I do agree with Alan on this.
Nobody's saying that anymore. Certainly not this administration.
No.
They are fit to be tired. What do we do? That.
But here's what I'm going to say this, because there's a whole other aspect on this, is the inability of the administration to truly get their hands wrapped around it. When we saw Secretary Jay Johnson, Secretary of Department of Homeland Security, along with officials from the Department of Justice, Executive Office of Immigration Courts, when we see members of HHS, which are the ones who take into custody refugee children who arrive here, and we see all of them lined up on a dais in front of the full Senate Homeland Security Committee trying to justify a $3.7 billion supplemental budget item, and everyone, bipartisan question, what are you going to do with this money? Nobody had an answer. Bob Hines, that would shock the living bejesus out of me if I'm sitting on the Senate dais. Am I wrong?
Well, I don't know what the answer to the problem is, but if I were a senator, I don't know where I would go on this issue. I understand what Alan is saying, and I think he's absolutely right. That's the way the world has always worked with this stuff. But I don't know, and I'd like to have a timeline. I'd like to know when these coyotes started bringing these young people in. How long ago was it? Because I didn't see a whole lot of reportage about this, let's say 8 months ago, 10 months ago, 6 months ago even. But what I don't understand is how the administration did not respond quickly when they realized what was happening, which they clearly did not do.
I can tell you from talking to sources that I have inside the Border Patrol and DHS, they've known that this was going to be a possibility the day the president announced DACA. DACA, I believe, is a good program. That's going to tick off a lot of people in my party. You know what? Call me a rhino. I don't care. DACA is a good program. What they didn't do is go on an international marketing effort saying, make no mistake about it, kids. This is not a feet wet, feet dry situation. Whereas if you get feet dry on American soil, we welcome you with open arms. This is a situation, if you're already here, then we'll defer action. This is not the golden ticket. That's where the administration messed up on it.
Well, that's a damn big mess.
It is a big, of course it's a big mess.
Yeah.
But the reality still dictates, and this is where I differ from Alan, is knowing what I know about the kids that are coming out of El Salvador, knowing the current political situation, knowing the influence of the criminal enterprises in these countries and how they've expanded throughout northern Latin America and northern Central America, to say that we can stop them at the Mexican border, the infiltration of these gangs into the federales, into the provincial police organizations, into the central government of Mexico, has been widely documented. The drug cartels will exploit these kids if they have the opportunity. That is why I say without fail, these are refugees, and the only way they're going to find safe haven is to get out of Latin America right now.
Well, by your definition, then everybody from Mexico South is a refugee. If there's no safe place in Mexico, then there's no safe place for Mexicans in Mexico. And then we haven't even talked about going south.
We haven't even talked about Nicaragua yet. I agree.
But all I'm trying to say is we cannot just and will not open our door to anybody from a crime-ridden or drug-ravaged community or country from here to
Tierra
Argentina,
del Fuego.
Tierra del Fuego, and say, come on down, we're here waiting for you, we will welcome you, we will clothe you and house you and give you health clearance and educate you. And I think you should suggest, you should take a look at what some of the historically democratic constituents in different parts of the country are saying. How dare you spend this kind of money for these foreigners who aren't welcome here and who don't belong here and deny us meeting all of our needs? I mean, this is a huge political dilemma for this administration and for Republicans as well.
All right. Well, we're going to keep an eye on this. We're going to continue this discussion in future programs because this is a situation not going away. It'll be interesting to see what the Congress does with the supplemental budget, and if DHS can get their act together, it's going to be amazing.
Wait, the House does something?
No, stop. Go away. When we come back, Peter Finn from the Washington Post, author of the Zhivago Affair, is going to talk about his book. This is a fascinating story about using literature and the Cold War and propaganda. Oh, it's a great story. I can't wait. He's going to be on here in the 5 o'clock hour. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We will be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Back Room that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland Scotches, they've got Isle of Skye Scotches, blended, single malt, anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays.
one more time. One more once.
Back here live at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is the best political talk show you've never heard of. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. Joining us now, live from Washington, he is Washington Post Peter Finn, who is also the author of a really fascinating book called The Zhivago Affair. Peter, how are you doing?
Good. How are you? Great to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Hey, Peter, we saw the articles back in April leading up to the release of the book, and then the book has gotten some great reviews that I've seen. It's a fascinating story of literature, a Russian poet, romance, ideology, and propaganda and the CIA. Give us a little bit of background on how you came up with the idea and why Dr. Zhivago?
Well, I came across the story when I was a correspondent in Moscow for the Washington Post, and a Russian writer gave a lecture in the city claiming that the CIA won the Nobel Prize in literature for Pasternak. That proved to be incorrect, but it got me interested in the subject. I began to read about Pasternak and Dr. Zhivago. He spent 10 years writing this. You know, it's a novel about the doctor-poet Yuri Zhivago, his art, his loves, his losses in the decades surrounding the 1917 revolution. And in it is some criticism of all that flowed from the revolution, and when literary bureaucrats in Moscow read it, you know, they found it unacceptable because it didn't, you know, hew to the literary norms of Soviet Russia. So he gave it to a young Italian who took the book out of the Soviet Union, and it was first published in Italy in translation in November 1957, then subsequently in a number of other Western countries, but not in Russian. And that's when the CIA got involved, and they decided that they would print a Russian edition to smuggle back into the Soviet Union so people there could read the novel.
So, Peter, you know, when we first heard about the whole Zhivago affair, you know, the book was widely acclaimed as a great piece of literature. However, President Eisenhower and his Operations Coordinating Board, were they the key factors that kind of touched off the entire effort to get this to the other side of the Iron Curtain?
No, I think it was the Soviet-Russia division within CIA, which was a division with, you know, specialists in Russia. They got a copy of the manuscript on film from British intelligence. When people read it, and they were already reading some of the reaction to it in Europe, they were hugely enthusiastic and believed that this was the kind of book that they wanted to print and smuggle back in. And when they were contemplating this in early 1958, the CIA had already begun what became known as the Books Program, and that was a program to secure the copyrights, print, publish, and smuggle Western books, Russian books that were not available in the Soviet Union, books about all kinds of subjects from art history to economics to history, to smuggle all of these books into the Soviet Union. Dr. Zhivago was one of the early efforts at this, and one of the most important because of the significance of this novel.
But you know, when we look at the background on this, you came across a CIA memo which went out to all the branch chiefs that said that this book has great propaganda value. What did the CIA see in the propaganda value of Dr. Zhivago versus another Soviet printed book?
Well, I think two things. One, Dr. Zhivago was, unlike any book that had previously come out of the Soviet Union, Soviet books, Soviet literature were written in praise of the Soviet experiment. Dr. Zhivago was critical of that experiment. So in that sense, it was, you know, completely original and startling to people who read it in the West that this book could have emerged from the Soviet Union. Secondly, the Soviet Union had banned the book, so there was great propaganda value in highlighting that fact and getting the book back in to the Soviet Union, so people there would wonder, why do we have to get these underground copies? Why is our own government banning this? So they were two motivations there.
Now, Pasternak, when he was originally, I guess, prohibited from publishing this book, once the book went into publication and they just did, how long did it take the Soviet regime to discover that this banned book by Pasternak was in fact in circulation in Russia?
Oh, almost immediately. I mean, they knew from the moment he gave the book over to that young Italian who took it out that the book was out, and the book was in the West. They made great efforts to try and get the manuscript back from Italy, pressuring both Pasternak and the Italian publisher, who happened to be a very prominent Italian communist. But he broke with the Italian Communist Party over this issue and went forward with publication. When they printed the book themselves, they handed it out at the Brussels World's Fair, and people immediately knew that this edition was out there and people were attempting to bring it back in. So I would say the Soviet authorities knew about this from the beginning.
Did the KGB...
But they knew this throughout the course of the Cold War. They were constantly trying to stop these books from getting in, with some success and, you know, a lot of failures, because these books did get in. People did pass them hand to hand.
Did Peter, did the KGB or the Kremlin, did they feel that they had failed as an internal security operation in keeping the book out? I mean, was this a humiliating experience for the Kremlin?
Yes, but not because they failed to keep it out. I think they came to believe that they lost the propaganda war over this book and that they might have been much better off if they had not made such an issue out of it, if they had not publicized their hostility to it so much, if they had not forced Pasternak, for instance, to renounce the Nobel Prize, if they had not humiliated and vilified him in their own media, and that if they had simply had a small print run of this book, paid no attention to it, and simply said to people in the West, what are you talking about? Yes, we've published this book. This would have passed off with much less attention. But they did everything in their power, even though it wasn't their intention, to make this book a global sensation.
Alan Moore, question for Peter Finn.
No, I that is exactly the question I had, whether there was there was any remorse on reflection about this tactic to try to stop a book. It was probably, were there any books anywhere in the world before that where they might have learned that if you try to stop it, you're likely to make it into a bigger deal than a lesser deal? I guess that's one question. And the other question is whether you think that since then, the Soviets then or the Russians later or anybody else has realized, gosh, remember what happened with Zhivago. Don't try to stop this, or we're going to create a martyr, if you will, in a writer, or call too much attention to something controversial. And the last thing we want to do is give it a bigger life than it otherwise might have.
Well, I think even Pasternak himself told them, told the authorities that, you know, you would be much better off to publish even an abridged version of this book. But, you know, its contents were so anathema to them, they couldn't bring themselves to do it. I do think that they did learn a lesson from this, and the future, with the possible exception of Solzhenitsyn, but with other writers, they made much less of an issue out of books than they had over the Zhivago affair. And in fact, even if you take a look at the Soviet leader at the time, Khrushchev, he eventually, in retirement, after he was forced from power, came to read Dr. Zhivago, something he didn't do at the time. He was handed a bunch of quotations from his underlings who said, look at the awful stuff that's in this novel. But when he did actually read the book in full, he said to himself, and he said in his memoirs, you know, why did I allow this to happen? We should never have done this. We should have just allowed this book to be published.
What were some of the more problematic at the time quotes that were in this book? What would have been on the list of items that went to Khrushchev back in the day when they were deciding to try to stop it?
I think, you know, where Yuri Zhivago himself is reflecting on the recent past, reflecting on the revolution, the famine, and the civil war, and he begins to describe the Bolsheviks as fanatics and people who, you know, all they can do, that they act like a machine that grinds up people, but they cannot govern. So it's sentiments like that that they found completely unacceptable. And it has to be said, you know, the book is not full of these kind of sentiments. Pasternak did not believe this was a particularly political book. And these sentiments are expressed here and there, but much of the rest of the book is not overtly political in that way. But any sentiment along these lines that failed to accept the October Revolution and everything that flowed from it, they couldn't countenance publishing that kind of book.
Peter, how much did the CIA actually put forth money-wise to get this operation and get the book published in Russian?
Well, I don't have an exact figure, and I imagine it was modest. I mean, they did two printings. The first printing was a hardback, their experience, and it was a small print run of about 1,100 copies that were handed out at the Brussels World's Fair in September 1958. The lesson they learned from that was that the book as a hardback was too big, too bulky, even though it was a very handsome book, to be easily smuggled. So the following year, they printed about 9,000 copies of a miniature paperback book on Bible stock paper in 1 and 2 volumes, which people could literally hold in their hand, the palm of their hand, and stuff in their pockets. So I would say a quite modest amount, but the book program itself, they spent millions of dollars a year on that over the course of the Cold War. And over those decades, they probably printed 10 million books and journals for circulation in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. So it was, you know, it was not a small amount of money.
So, of course, Alan Moore, you described those two volumes. Have you held those volumes? Are they famous, rare books, and what are they worth?
Well, I have a miniature, the one printed in 1959, and my co-author, Petra Kuve, has a copy of the hardback, which was published in the Netherlands. She's Dutch, and she got it actually as a gift from a Dutch intelligence officer who worked, that agency worked with the CIA to get this printing done. I imagine they're worth a few dollars. I haven't priced them out. Uh-huh. It's just nice to have one.
Oh, it must be fabulous.
Peter, obviously, Director Dulles, the director of Central Intelligence back in the day, probably looked at this and then the explosion of the circulation after the Youth Festival. How much did this spark a more cultural aspect in the CIA versus the traditional clandestine operations, or did it have an effect?
Well, I think the cultural aspect of the Cold War perhaps became more important after the Hungarian Revolution, and there was some realization within CIA that they were in a very long game, that communism in Eastern Europe was not going to be turned back. I mean, this was just one, culture was just one weapon in their arsenal, if you like, but it was an important one, and if you include everything they were doing, not just books, but Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe, all the cultural activities they were underwriting in Western Europe to shore up support for the U.S. I mean, it was a major effort over the course of the Cold War.
Peter, when we look at this today, you obviously had some access with CIA officials and the CIA. Was the organization cooperative in your research for the book?
Yes. I mean, you know, it took a while. When I came back from Moscow in 2008, I approached the agency about the possibility of securing documents from them on what they had or had not done. Their first response was no, not interested. But then I spoke to retired people in D.C. who then went and spoke to others inside the agency. Gradually, the historians within the Historical Records Division became interested and found what material they had. They oversaw whatever internal process there was to release these documents, and I eventually got them in 2012.
Oh,
so
wow.
It was, you know, 3-year process.
Oh, wow. When in the aftermath, I mean, obviously it turned into a huge motion picture. Obviously, did that motion picture, was there any attempt to bring the movie into the Cold War aspect, get that translated into Soviet?
Well, the movie was banned in the Soviet Union, and like the book, was not available for Soviet citizens to see, or like the book, to read until Gorbachev came to power. And the movie is a much harder thing to smuggle, obviously, than a book, because you have to have a place to show it. Now, the American Embassy in Moscow did have some private screenings of Dr. Zhivago, the movie, when it came out, after it came out in 1965, but that was really the extent of it. People did not see the movie.
Do Russians today embrace Dr. Zhivago as a piece of literature, or is there still a faction of Russians that look at it as it was an undermining of our government at the time, set off by the capitalist United States?
No, I don't think so. I think that if you walk into any bookstore in Moscow or St. Petersburg, you'll see it there on the shelf. I think people read it less now than they did in the past. You know, it's not generally part of the curriculum in Russian schools, even though other writers like Tolstoy and others are. So maybe it's not as popular, particularly among younger and readers, than it might have been in the past. Obviously, there was a huge interest in reading it when it was forbidden. Like anything that's forbidden, people want it. Now that they can read anything they want, pretty much, in terms of literature, there's less interest. And the Russian state does not take a huge interest in literature anymore. That's not where their internal control or their interests in internal control lie.
Carl Tuvin, question for Peter Fenn.
Peter, with all the books being printed and sold worldwide, did Pasternak receive any royalties or any compensation for all the books that were printed at that time?
Well, that was a hugely complicated issue, which we describe in the book. So he had no direct access to the money, and there were huge sums of money. By 1 year after, there must have been $1 million in Swiss bank accounts that his publisher had put there for him. He needed the money because he was essentially no longer getting work internally, so his publisher and other friends in the West started to smuggle money in suitcases. This was a highly risky venture. Pasternak, unfortunately, died 18 months after the whole Nobel controversy in 1958, but after his death, his mistress was accused of illegal currency trading and convicted and sentenced to 8 years in prison and sent off to the camps. This is a woman who, when he was writing the book, was also sent to the camps for her association with him. Pasternak, among other things, had a very or a somewhat complicated private life with essentially two families, his wife and children, and his mistress and her children.
Did final question for you here, Peter. We know you're busy. Did Pasternak, before he died, realize the effect and the popularity of the book globally?
Yes, he did.
Get a sense of that?
Yes, he did, and he was enormously gratified by that, and he was, you know, incredibly happy not only at the global popularity but at winning the Nobel Prize, because he viewed this novel as his final testament, as the artistic achievement of a long, long life of writing. I mean, prior to writing this novel, he was regarded as one of the great Russian poets, but he saw this novel, he saw Dr. Zhivago as his, at one point he called it his final happiness and madness.
Wow. Peter Fenn, obviously available in hardback, in brick and mortar stores, and available on Amazon.
Correct.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. Alan Moore's got one last question for you.
No. I'm thinking about your initial comment when you said, when there was the question, gee, did the CIA bring him the Nobel Prize? It sounds to me like the Russian government brought him the Nobel Prize, and then the CIA was simply a foot soldier in that process.
Yeah, I mean, the Nobel Prize, I mean, I can answer that briefly. You know, he had been nominated for the Nobel Prize several times before Dr. Zhivago was ever known about as a poet. I think the arrival, the appearance of Dr. Zhivago and the reaction of people within the Swedish Academy to it made him a shoo-in for the award in 1958.
Wow. Okay. Fascinating book. Peter Fenn, reporter for the Washington Post, author of The Zhivago Affair. Peter, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to be with us here on Backroom Politics.
No, thank you. I appreciate it.
Not a problem. Hey, when we come back, we're going to have a discussion on, believe it or not, Bob, Al, your sweet spot. We're going to talk about redistricting, the Texas problem, and the possible
Yay.
Florida problem. When we come back on Backroom Politics, we'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. Everybody knows Shelley's Back Room for its corporate events, its happy hours, its famous campfire wings and fruit cigars and drinks. But what you didn't know is that Shelley's is open during the weekend, too. In fact, Shelley's Back Room on the weekends even has a non-smoking section. You can bring your family, your kids, enjoy the same campfire wings and same glorious food that you enjoy during the week, but without the famous Shelley's cigar environment. Also, during the weekend, it's football season. That means a lot of the regulars come down and enjoy their drinks and their favorite cigars, all while watching their favorite local teams, whether it's the Ravens, the Redskins, on several HD screens throughout the place. So remember, Shelley's Back Room, it's not just for happy hours anymore. 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., official sponsor of Backroom Politics.
No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the elevation, on the shelf, ain't misbehaving, saving my love for you, and you, especially you, yeah. I know for certain, the one I love, I'm through with flirting, it's you that I'm thinking of, ain't misbehaving, saving all my love for you. Like Jack Horner, in a corner, don't go nowhere, what do I care? Your kisses are worth waiting for. Believe me, I don't stay out late, no place to go. I'm home about 8 at my little radio. Ain't misbehaving, saving my love for you, for you, for you, yes, you. All my love for you. Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
And we're back here live at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 S Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is the best political talk show you've never heard of. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. Hey, we're going to talk about a subject that's near and dear to Congressman Allen, Bob Hines' heart. We're going to talk about, hold yourselves here, kids. We're talking redistricting. And has now gotten back into the headlines. If you have not been watching, there's a redistricting problem down in Texas. The problem is that apparently the Supreme Court and several other courts below them have said that, wait a minute, the recent 2010 redistricting was not only unconstitutional, but just a blatant effort in gerrymandering. So the question is coming up now then. There are other states now that are now calling into question, one of them being possibly Florida. And Florida's redistricting problems. Dan Lipner, you want to add to this?
Well, in Florida's case, I can't speak to Texas. In Florida's case, it's actually the state courts that have said the redistricting was violated the state's constitution.
The state Supreme Court. I'm sorry. I should qualify that. That is correct.
Also state law.
Right.
Correct. But this brings up a good question, though. I mean, you know, you now have Texas. You now have the possibility that Florida's redistricting efforts after the 2010 census could be called unconstitutional. If that is the case, Bob Hines, does this become a wake-up call to the general electorate saying, hey, wait a minute, as boring as redistricting sounds, our voices really aren't getting heard? Should this wake up the electorate and saying, look, we got to take more of an interest in this?
Well, it would be nice to believe it, but I don't think that's necessarily true. But the way we redistrict, and both parties are equal opportunity offenders. The way we do redistricting right now is I think if the founding fathers were to see how what's going on today, they probably say, my God, you got to fix something. Simple as that. You got to fix something. There's a number of ways you could do it, but you've got to do something about it.
Dan Lipner.
Well, not only that, let's throw one number out there. The number is 470,000 votes last election. That's how many more votes, this is just for the House, mind you, Democrats got than Republicans, yet Democrats are in the minority in the House of Representatives. Taking that number into account, the fact that, both parties are equal offenders, and now with modern technology, I would push back on. The fact that you have districts that defy logic, my personal favorite, I think the district has since been changed, but once Texas had a district that was only contiguous because of a highway overpass and underpass that kept it actually contiguous. This is the only thing that the court has said consistently.
There's a great one in Maryland that goes from the West Virginia border to the Eastern Shore. That's a really good gerrymandering.
Now, by the way, I got
a Democrat.
Wait a minute.
They're equal opportunity offenders, period.
It goes from Western Maryland into Montgomery County, where they took sections of Montgomery County, which are heavily Democratic, to make that a Democratic district. But it didn't go all the way to the Eastern Shore.
Might as well have. Jeez. So in an effort to wake up Alan Moore, because he's yawning already on this subject. I mean, we can't always be interesting, but it's politically. All right, I'll go to Congressman Al. Congressman Al, you had a comment.
Yeah, I just want to give Alan time to go to sleep. I think the problem with a number of important revisions or reforms, if you will, have not done well because they have not been sold well. A bunch of college professors and mugwumps like Bob and I talk about this in almost classic political science terms. And the public, one, isn't interested in that, and two, it just sounds like something else that the politicians are bitching about, and why should I be interested?
But Carl Tooven from... Oh, I'm sorry.
Wait a minute. That was my preamble.
Yeah.
Prelude.
Oh, I didn't know there was
more.
Woke
me up.
You let him have prelude.
Go ahead.
I'm with Al here.
Yeah.
His are interesting.
Or just lewd.
Well, do I leave on this point?
No, deeply. We're still live, Al. Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
It seems to me that what people don't understand is that what the current process of redistricting does is it allows the Congress people, the politicians, to choose their constituency, and when it should be the other way around, the constituency chooses the politician. That, I think, could get through to the public along with a bunch of other stuff.
Dan Lipner.
In 2 years ago, I was in Ohio that also was suffering from the redistricting fight. And in an attempt to fight the redistricting, the Democratic Party proposed a novel solution that said, depending on the voter registration of the state is how they should then proceed to draw the lines that make up districts in order to get the proper distribution between Democrats and Republicans. I immediately chimed in that this is also incorrect. The actual correct answer is something plain as day on the map. Marcy Kaptur, the dean of the women in the House of Representatives, her district, she represented Toledo, Ohio for close to 30 years now. Her district now extends from Toledo to Cleveland. And the correct argument, at least in my mind, is not the choosing the voters or anything else. It's actually letting the communities be defined. And as I proposed to the Democratic Party and in Ohio, that it should be a regionalism issue, that the folks in Toledo are not part of Cleveland, and Cleveland sure as hell is not part of Toledo. Let those folks identify themselves and let the district shape up around that identity.
Congressman Al.
I agree with that. What I am suggesting is you need something like a slogan. You need something to get their attention. And that then becomes the argument that makes sense.
The Mudhens versus the Indians. Go with that.
And it's an argument that I think can break through the malaise that exists on the issue. If you can get their attention on the fact that they're being used by the
politicians.
And then your argument, and there are a number of others that I think can be made logically to a group once you've got them listening. But you got to get them listening before they'll pay any attention.
Alan, you still awake?
I'm drowsy here.
Okay.
Carl,
right,
let's leave him. Let him go to sleep.
I'm intrigued with the notion that this could be somehow a popular movement. Most people don't even know who their representative is. These off-year elections have very low turnouts. It's you're going to have to get people to care about elections before you're going to then get them to care about redistricting. In many cases, the redistricting works where both parties scratch each other's back to have safe seats in both cases. It is not to say that the party in power doesn't have the power typically to make the hard marginal choices and come out with a majority. And as Dan accurately points out, if you aggregate everything at the end, then you say, gosh, is that really a good system? The only way, though, to get around this is to get state-by-state buy-in to the creation of an independent group. Occasionally that happens. It happened in California. And there's a few other – I don't know if there's any other states where there's actually a commission that is charged with drawing these population focus.
Iowa.
So, you know, the states have to decide, and
well, it's Washington.
And I don't see this movement kind of evolving. I wanted to say one other thing about the Florida Supreme Court case. There's 27 districts in Florida. The state Supreme Court said two of them are bad.
Yeah.
And now the big question
is... But that redraws the entire map.
Right.
Well, if you have to, but then the question is, what do we do for 2014? Because they're about to send out absentee ballots.
Right.
So the losers in that case said, God forbid you should say we have to do something before 2014 because we've
already got everything done. We're ready to go.
Complicated stuff. We don't have time.
But okay. Hold on. Carl Tooman.
The interesting thing is in the Florida situation where they said, you know, Democrats had more votes for president as Republicans and this, that, and the other. And then they said, well, the whole thing should be redone, but there's not enough time between now and the November election to do it. And Corinne Brown says, don't do that. My district's fine.
Yeah. Hers was one of the districts.
I was going to say, have you seen Corinne Brown's district?
Yes.
Yeah.
It looks like a boa constrictor coming out of the Everglades. It's amazing.
Well, and that's one of the things we can't really overlook. I mean, there's Democrat and Republican, but then there's also the protected class that actually needs to be paid attention to. Racial politics does play a role in this. So majority-minority districts do need to be – because gerrymandering used to be about – making sure minority voters could not actually have a real voice in politics. Well, however, that has now changed.
It used to be for a while. It started with Eldridge Gerry, who did it not for those reasons at all, but for the standard reasons of making...
Wanted to make sure he was still in office. I mean, this is... Look, redistricting is no more than politicians ganging up. When you put it into legislative hands, it is no more than politicians talking to other politicians saying, hey, how do we remain in office? You scratch my back, I scratch yours. It has become a little cabal in many states, particularly in your larger population states, i.e., Texas and Florida.
We had a Senate majority leader, a Democrat, in Washington State who was so fixated on the idea that if he only studied this hard enough, he could get every legislative district to be Democratic, until some of his friends were thinking that he was going slightly mad. He would hold up in an office for days, letting the Senate run itself. He was the majority leader, while he was searching for this magical theory. Well, look, let me tell you, no matter how you do redistricting, you're going to get more Republicans out of Texas and more Democrats out of Boston, and we're not trying to make things perfect. But I come back to the fact you've got to have something that will draw their attention to it, and that is that these crooked politicians have set it up so that they will choose whether you vote for
Dan Lipner.
True, there's more to this.
Dan Lipner.
There's more to this, because the extremes that the House has turned into, and hell, Eric Cantor was a victim of this, that by drawing these districts, the true losers are the majority of the American public, meaning the moderates, the people in between that actually want problems solved. When you draw these lines that it becomes a safe partisan district, and as we know, almost universally, if not absolutely universally nationwide, the people who vote in primaries are the extremes of either party. So if those are the people choosing the members, and Eric Cantor, a shock to everyone, was taken out by the extremes of his own party because of that redistricting, because they painted a bit more of the radical right into his district, lo and behold, he ran into trouble. And this is – it's a larger issue than just the you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. The larger population now produces something that is no longer a functioning government. And that's where we need to be paying attention.
And I absolutely agree with you when you want to get down a little bit into the weeds of the issue. But that's where you begin to glaze the eyes over of the average voter, although I hate...
Average voters like Alan, apparently.
I hate to think of Alan as an average voter, but that's
I'm definitely above average.
and humble, too.
I need to believe that.
And humble, too. Carl Tooman.
The one thing I didn't like about the commission in California is the way they cut the districts, and all of a sudden you had Berman running against Sherman, and which was one of two good people were going to be knocked out. And I think that is not right. But
you can't have it both ways.
The California plan is actually the solution, because it produced a situation where, even barring the insanity of the lines being drawn, which actually California no longer has, but if every state had to have a general election with either the top two Republicans or top two Democrats running against each other, I mean, Louisiana has a similar system, by the way, you end up still having...
Yes, we see how effective that is.
So does Washington State.
And
it's a stupid system.
What, with a general election, you can have two Democrats or two Republicans running against each other?
Any state that decides they're going to take anything out of Louisiana and make it their policy.
California has a functioning government for the first time at least in 20 years.
Well, that's arbitrary. Jerry Brown hasn't functioned for decades.
Wait a minute. Hey. He's gotten California out of a lot of trouble.
Okay, I'm sorry. Bob Hines.
Listen, to me, what I would like to see is the way Iowa does it. They've got...
It's a square state with four districts.
They have a commission made up of former governors, former Supreme Court judges.
And a surveyor.
And what they do is they draw compact and contiguous districts. They put communities
together. It's a square state, Bob.
But you can make a square state, but you can still have, you can carve out six
areas. With four congressmen? How? You basically cut it up like a Sicilian pizza. Yeah. One line up, one line across.
No, okay.
When they had five, it was a little bit more complicated.
Yeah. But it clear, Justin, that you like gerrymandering.
Yes, it's clear.
No. I'm not a fan of gerrymandering.
It's absolutely clear.
Yes, it's clear.
Everything you said.
Oh, now you're taking what I say out of context.
No, we're taking what you said.
What you said and taking it back to you. Doesn't sound so good, does it?
Yeah.
By the way, the breaking news coming out of CNN right now. CNN is reporting that the Israeli security cabinet is in emergency meetings. It appears that the ceasefire has not taken hold. Apparently, according to CNN and according to BBC, several rockets have been launched into Israel just within the past couple of hours. The Iron Dome system has been activated and several anti-missile defense rockets have been fired. CNN is broadcasting a picture of these rockets actually going after targets. So this continues to de-escalate into an absolute quagmire.
It's a slick way of you getting out of discussing what we were discussing.
Just doing my journalistic duty, Al.
Just call him Jerry.
Yeah.
Jerry has no manners.
Thank you. At least you've called me something close to my name today.
What I would like to see in every state is the same kind of a commission that Iowa has, where Supreme Court former retired justice and former governors, you know, five or six people, do the work. And they draw compact and contiguous districts, which puts communities together, which means you've got from everybody from way up here to way down here, because they all live in the same neighborhoods. Let's stay together. And that way, you're going to have the best possible choices, because you're not going to have the Tea Party is on one side and the crazy libs on the other side.
But
I want to see a situation where, as much as possible, we get a redistricting set up, which the politicians cannot negotiate.
But, Bob, doesn't that bring into play then, you then go out of the hands of the legislature, those
good.
Elected? But
what a great idea.
But doesn't
the legislature
bring...
doesn't make a deal with the congressional delegation.
But wait a minute. Does it not bring into play the old political boss system, old Tammany Hall regimes?
Not at all.
No, well, there's an important difference. Whether or not you're talking about somebody fudging the lines a number of blocks versus a few hundred miles, there is a very distinct difference. There's always going to be a little mucking around with it. Let's just concede that point. But when you have something that draws a 1 mile wide line 100 miles to link communities that have nothing to do with each other versus moving a line a few blocks because you think there are a few more voters of yours versus the other guy. You're not going to get rid of that, but you can get rid of it. Can you at least make it compact so it at least makes sense?
But I'm going to ask
exactly what Al and I have been talking about.
Right, but what I want to do is I want
to
ask.
The only way to do that is take it out of the hands of the state legislatures doing deals with the congressional delegation, which is exactly what we have today.
Hey, Bob, my hand's raised. So,
no, I was talking.
Oh, excuse me. Excuse me. Carl Toon from.
Is somebody talking?
Yes.
Oh, Alan's awake again.
Steve,
go back to sleep.
Carl Toobin, from a Democratic or Republican chair or executive director, this obviously puts the state parties in an awkward position, whereas your job as an executive director or a party chair in these states is to do what you can to get your party elected. At the same time, you do want to have congressional districts that aren't going to be disqualified by constitutional rule. Can the state parties find a balance in those two missions
where they
can be compatible?
Absolutely.
It would be very, very hard to. I mean, you know, this thing with Western Maryland. You know, we have a congressman that lives in Montgomery County. His district, as I said before, was made in Montgomery County to have enough votes to counter Western Maryland. Western Maryland should have a congressman of their own and most likely be Republican as it was prior. Only a few times has that district
or a
been.
Very conservative Democrat as with Beverly Byron.
Well, Beverly Byron, but you also had Foley years ago. I can't think of his first name, but he was a Liberal Democrat and happened to be able to win that district.
Kind of like Chris Christie in New Jersey, running governor. Oh, come on, that was cute.
And how
really?
Is that district drawn?
And yet that drew no ire from Alan Moore.
Alan is still resting.
Oh, okay, that's true.
He made it over the bridge, that's why he did it.
That's true. Hey, final question on this. These are obviously situations that are going to be continuously challenged. At what point does the Supreme Court get involved and just mandate down, look, this...
No.
Will they?
The court should not do this.
It's on track to.
Well, yeah, probably will.
No.
Hold on.
Alan Moore's got a fact.
No. Let's remember that one of the things that started this was a Supreme Court decision from the 1950s that required one man, one person, one vote. So you had to create districts of more or less equal population. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just reminding everybody that before that decision was made, we had many states who had districts that were not dissimilar from the difference between the Senate and the House. They were geographic regions, not based on population. That was overturned in the 50s, and ever since then, the machinations have at least required that the districts be of approximately equal size at the time the decisions were made.
What we
but the reason for that was so...
Hold on, Dan Lipner.
Well, again, we glossed over this, but again, the reason for the court even took the case is because of the protected class, the racial politics at play. It's all sort of in the South. The fact that it's migrated nationwide is both a curse and a blessing.
The reality today is we have in the House with 435 members, we have probably about 360 districts that are drawn on a 75-25 basis.
Our associate producer, Eric Thomas, is like right now completely glazed eyes over. He's completely...
Then he is like most of the citizens in the United States who don't understand how serious this problem can be.
You mean you want the American electorate to take personal responsibility for the way that they're governed?
It would be nice if at least they paid attention to the fact that it's all screwed up today.
You know what? I want a pink unicorn, too.
As Thomas Jefferson said, to reaching out to our Tea Party fans, the most dangerous threat to democracy is an unenlightened public.
You're talking about an electorate, a libertarian party that has embraced the Lego movie as a mantra for libertarianism. Are you kidding me? Good God.
I pass.
Exactly. Exactly. With that, we've got 10 minutes left in the show. It is time for my favorite part of the show. It's time for Tell Me a Story. We talk about news, innuendo, rumors going around the beltways. Once in a while, we'll scoop them. But Congressman, no, you're not ready yet. Bob.
I'm ready.
You are.
I'm ready.
Congressman Al, tell me a story.
Story is that if we can change the approach to selling redistricting from all of the technical stuff that everybody around this table understands and probably our wives and families do not, to explain to them how it is this current system hurts them by putting those nasty politicians in charge of choosing them as constituents rather than letting the constituents choose the member. If we did that, we would be able to start something that would grow.
Interesting. Wow. He's a former congressman, Alan. Bob Hines, tell me a story.
The primary season is just about over, I think it is. And as a Republican, I am very pleased.
Mississippi's still going on, by the way.
Just a little bit, but not much.
Wait, but, Bob Hines.
The reality is, it's most of it's passed now, and I'm very pleased with the way that the Tea Party has been put in place and pushed off to the side of it, because I think it's important that we don't have people who are so rigid that they are unable to negotiate. And I think it's going to be a better Congress the next time around, because they're going to be fewer Tea Party types. And the stronger the Republican Party can be, and so that it can be as good...
With more Tea Party people?
Less Tea Party people.
Okay, just making
That's
sure.
That's what we need.
Okay.
The fewer the better. And
happy
we,
days are here again.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well,
Carl Tubin. Carl Tubin, is this story modern day?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Within the past 2 years.
From page one of yesterday's newspaper.
Hey! Oh, my God. How surprising.
I was
going to
throw in a story, but I'm not going to do that. Senator Begich has, from Alaska, has now campaigning on the fact that he is a nagger. And he has
a what?
Nagger.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, my God.
N-A-G-G-E-R. Nagger.
Right.
I thought he was a Democrat. We didn't even party.
The new N-word.
Okay.
He has been running for election in Alaska for the fact that he has nagged the President of the United States like a thorn in his posterior, according from the Post. He says that he has access to badger the administration, and he has gotten things like more permits for oil and gas drilling for Alaska. And as he goes throughout the state, he talks about what he's done. There was a nomination for a four-star general, and he held that nomination back until he convinced the administration's Department of Defense to keep F-47s in Alaska and not move them to someplace else.
Okay.
And he also did the same thing about a hospital in Alaska where he badgered the administration. They gave him the money for Alaska, and he let a bill go through.
Okay, I think I got what you said, but can you tell me again, because I didn't hear a thing you said. Adam Moore, tell me the story.
All right, so Harry Reid.
Oh my God, it's a Harry Reid story. It's been 2 weeks. It's been 2 weeks.
He continues his personal assault on the prestige and stature of the job of Senate Majority Leader. Hopefully the damage that he continues to do won't be permanent, but by there's now some interesting evidence that his constant references and attacks on the Koch brothers from the Senate floor, where he won't bring up any bills, but he will simply attack the Koch brothers.
He wants big money out of politics, Alan.
He's had the effect of now causing other major donors to want to operate in the shadows. Because once you start from the Senate floor attacking big donors, whether it's Koch brothers or Marvin Adelson or Tom Steyer, the wealthy Democrat from San Francisco, you're going to drive this stuff indoors. And whether people attack or not is fine. The Senate Majority Leader doing it from the Senate floor is just wrong. Maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I think that it's an embarrassment to him, to the Senate, to the role of Majority Leader, and to Democrats.
You are old-fashioned.
He also wants to bring back earmarks.
I'm in favor of that. I like that idea. But Dan Lipner, tell me a story.
Well, going back to the story I was cheated out of last week, thanks to the World Cup, but I will predict that the Dow will break 30,000 when all companies that are publicly listed become Christian Scientists in order to avoid Obamacare, thanks to the Hobby Lobby decision.
I waited for that. I waited for that. In a Yogi Berra, it's deja vu all over again. The Florida governor's race has continued to just stupefy all logic in politics, where you have the current incumbent, Rick Scott, the Republican, who's always been about 2 inches away from total indictment in his Health South scandal. And you also have the former Republican governor of Florida in
Charlie Crist.
He is now in a neck and neck race for retaking the governor's race in Florida. The trick here is how a largely Republican regime in the legislature is going to be able to deal with a turncoat, i.e. Charlie Crist. Should he get elected, you're going to see a legislative logjam that's going to take kaopectate to release. You didn't like that one, Alan? Oh, come on. How many times?
He's still sleeping
for the redistricting.
Do it for me, sir.
Oh, I thought that would have been.
I think the Christian Scientist thing went better, though.
No, his nagger thing got us all.
That's what it's all asleep.
Yeah,
I think in the future we're going to go with nudge instead.
Yeah.
That is usual within the story. Oh.
What's in yesterday's Washington Post? A summary is not like the perfect
right
story.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd rather have some history. I think that's more interesting.
Possibly. Hey, I want to give special shout-out thanks to
90 seconds.
Our associate producers, Yarden Kakoa and Eric Thomas, and on behalf of Congressman Al Swift, Bob Hines, Carl Tuven, Alan Moore, Dan Lipner. I am your moderator, Radio's Justin Russell. We will be back live next week. Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Bob?
The place to be.
Absolutely. You can follow us on the web, www.backroompolitics.org. You can follow us on Twitter, @BackroomPolitics. And you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/backroompolitics, I think. Is that right, Yarden? You think so? Not the definitive answer I was looking for, kid. Really not helping. As she points to Eric Thomas, our other associate producer, it's his fault. Okay. Hey, we'll see you next week live from Shelley's Back Room. Have a great week, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Bye-bye.